This is Childhood Matters, presented by Interactive Parenting Media.
Childhood Matters.
For parents and everyone else who cares for or about kids.
We are family. Get up, everybody, and sing.
Here's your host, Rona Renner.
Good morning and welcome to Childhood Matters. With stories in the news like the Penn State sex abuse scandal, with allegations that former football coach Jerry Sandusky sexually assaulted or had inappropriate contact with at least 8 underage boys, I thought it was time to do another show on the highly charged subject of child sexual abuse. This topic is not addressed enough, especially when it comes to discussing ways to prevent this horrendous crime from happening to any child. I'm Nurse Rona, and I'm here each week to present important topics to parents, grandparents, foster parents, childcare providers, big sisters, big brothers, or anyone who cares for and about children. If your child is old enough to understand what we're talking about, you'll probably want to either turn off the radio or go in another room. We will have this show posted on our website at childhoodmatters.org by Monday afternoon. Child sexual abuse is a complex subject that's based on power and control, manipulation and seduction. Coaches, teachers, clergy, and parents are authority figures children feel they can trust, yet a large percentage of adults who sexually abuse children are from this group. Children have been taught to listen to and obey and trust these adults. It's up to us to teach children how to say no, but they don't always understand that they should. It's very complicated, and we have to keep our eyes and ears open so we can help to protect our children. It's estimated that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused by the time they are 18 years old. And 20% of the victims are under the age of 8. Most victims don't say anything to their parents right after the abuse, and many adults are in denial that someone they know and trust could be a perpetrator of abuse. Sometimes there are no clear signs that a child has been traumatized in this way. And so if your child has been abused and you missed it, you're not alone. The more we talk about this and learn from the experts, the better prepared we can be to prevent and treat child sexual abuse. If you want to be part of the conversation today, please call us. 877-372-KIDS. That's 877-372-5437. You can also email us at info@childhoodmatters.org. And if you have a question or a story and you don't want to use your real name, just tell our producer. It's not always easy to know how to get your questions answered on this topic. Joining us in the studio today, we have Dr. Jorge Partida. He's a psychologist, an author, and a consultant to businesses and the media. As a psychologist, he's worked in the areas of education, health, social services, leadership, economic development, and employment. He also focuses on the influence of culture, spirituality, and the study of healing and wellness. He's worked extensively with the Latino and African American community and youth and families who are challenged by poor health, addiction, abuse, violence, and incarceration. Dr. Jorge served as director of the doctorate program in clinical psychology at John F. Kennedy University, and he was also the deputy director of behavioral health for the San Francisco Department of Public Health. For more than 8 years, he's been a weekly presenter for the Univision Television Network in Chicago and San Francisco. And currently, you can hear him on Thursdays. He has a program called Vive tu Promesa?
Vive tu Promesa.
Okay. Live your promise. And also, he served as the associate producer for Nuestra Familia. It's a PBS documentary exploring the nature of Latino gangs and organized crime. Dr. Jorge Partida, welcome back to Childhood Matters.
Nurse Rona, it's always a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you so much. With us also is Debbie McCann. She is a forensic interviewer and multidisciplinary team leader at Community Violence Solutions. She's worked as a child interview specialist at the Children's Interview Center in Contra Costa County since 2002. The center provides a variety of specialized services to children who have been sexually abused and their non-offending family members. She now directs the center and leads the Contra Costa County multidisciplinary team as well. She's a writer and a mom and lives in Oakland with her family and two dogs. Debbie McCann, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Jorge, let's start off with talking about why it's so essential for adults to be learning about the prevention of child sexual abuse and also the importance of treatment. What are some of the consequences of this type of trauma?
Well, I think that, you know, with all the media attention that we've received in the last 20 years especially, I think that the topic of sexual abuse has been so much more at the forefront than generations ago, where you know, the needs of children and the bodies of children were really not that well respected. And I think that for many individuals, and perhaps a lot more than we can imagine, the idea of suffering in silence has been a burden and something that, you know, we've had to carry for many, many years. And I think that now that there is more attention and that we begin to recognize and do more analysis and research, we recognize just the deep impact mm-hmm. of sexual abuse. It's not just that you're robbing a child of their innocence. It's not just that you're taking away the opportunity of self-discovery, that magic moment that happens when you realize that you have power, you have authority. It's that's tragic in and of itself. But when you couple it with the years that distort perception, and you get to the point where you're an adult and you've suffered sexual abuse, all of your relationships and your connection to reality is going to be a bit awkward. It's going to be shifted because you're much more tentative. You're less certain of yourself. You have issues with intimacy, with trust.
Trust is the big one.
You have issues with, you know, getting just allowing yourself to enjoy things like sex, intimacy, touch. And we don't recognize the huge burden and how this also gets passed on to the next generation. And so we perpetuate even children that are not sexually abused, who have grown up in an environment where there has been incest or abuse, become sort of tainted by that dynamic. And so we need to understand that this is a very serious issue. It is taking away the future of not just that child, but then the future of those families that the child is going to be connected to.
And I want to say that it's really important to say what you just said. And when there isn't silence, and when there's recognition, and when there's not denial, you know, healing is possible. And I think the problem with this particular issue is that there's so much stigma and silence and shame around
exactly.
it. So then the healing is harder to occur. So,
exactly. And the worst thing that can happen is that we don't believe children when they finally do have the courage to speak up. And we have so many stories in all cultures where that actually happens. And it's tragic that after all that a child has been through and they finally have the courage to say something, that it's the people that they love and trust the most that actually adds insult to injury by not believing them.
And it's understandable why that happens.
Absolutely.
And so that's why we're talking about this today, because we have to. And, you know, you hear stuff in the news and it's very sensational, but what you don't get is really the conversation about what we can do about this and how yeah. prevalent it is. And I want to ask you, Debbie McCann, you've worked with young children and parents for many years. What do you want parents to understand about the prevalence of child sexual abuse, and maybe a little bit about who the perpetrators are, what to look for?
Yeah, who the perpetrators are is not always who you expect it to be, or in our perceptions, who we fear that it may be. You know, there's a lot of fear of stranger danger and parents trying to protect their children by not letting them, you know, ride their bikes in the neighborhood or walk to school and that kind of thing. And it's just sort of interesting, our perspective and our perception of what we fear, because it's children, especially really young children, are not out of adult control very, very often. So kids are harmed by the people who have access to them. And that's generally not a stranger, but, you know, someone in their family or someone associated with their family, or as you said, a teacher or a coach. And but that's not how we tend to think of it. I did look up a few statistics from 1 year, 1997. I don't know why they have statistics only for years so long ago. But in that year, there were in the whole country, there were 115 true stranger abductions of children, 115 in the whole country. And of those, you know, 46 kids were killed, right? So in the same year, 1997, the number one cause of death for kids was actually motor vehicle accidents. 4,700 kids were killed, which is 13 every day, in car accidents. And yet we think nothing of strapping our kids in the car and driving them everywhere all the time. You know, three times a day we'll strap our kids in the car and drive them somewhere, but we don't think twice about it, but we're terrified to let them play at the park out of our sight. And it's, you know, it's sort of our perception is a little skewed there.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, you never know who it's going to be. And it could be someone you don't expect. And it may be someone you've entrusted your child to.
That's right. So that's what makes it really difficult. Mm. And I want this conversation to be continuing to talk about any signs and symptoms and how do you know how to protect your child. We have some books also to give away. We have children's book, one called I Said No, one called A Touching Book, and Not in Room 204. So if you have questions, concerns, give us a call, 1-877-372-KIDS. And I want to mention that we did a show last month called Talking to Kids of All Ages About Their Bodies and Sexuality. And this is a good show to listen to at our website at childhoodmatters.org because it's about healthy sex education for children of all ages. Robie Harris has wonderful books about that. And so we want to continue that conversation by saying there's you know, normal sex education that we have to start doing with our children. And then there's also this subject that we're talking about is really how to help them prevent being victims and also help them when they've been victims. Let's open up the phone lines this morning. We have Mick with us now from Berkeley. Good morning, Mick.
Hey.
Hey there. Good to hear from you this morning.
Yeah. This is a really nice show. Nice, and I guess not the right word. This is a really good show. I thought I'd tell a little bit about what happened to me, and then I have a few questions, actually.
Sure, go ahead.
When I was 14 or 15, I was molested by my stepfather. And I was able to say no, but he asked me or told me not to tell my mother. And I went along with it. But then he was still there. I was around the house, and he was around the house, and I actually was... I babysat for my little younger brothers, and so he was around after school quite a bit. Not all the time, but every now and then, and he was very uncomfortable. It was just uncomfortable. He you know, he would be suggestive, la-di-da. He would, you know, touch me occasionally, just like on my shoulder or something, or tickle me. Something. It was, you know...
Yeah.
Then maybe... A year later, a year and a half, he offered me money to do what he wanted me to do with him and what he wanted to do with me. And at that point, I said, this has gone too far. Actually, he put the money somewhere, and he said if it was gone, he'd know that I'd agreed. So I realized that if anybody took that money... he'd have the wrong idea, la-di-da. So I told my mother at that point. And she was very concerned, but it was clear she couldn't do anything about it. She didn't believe me to the point that she was going to take any steps.
Yeah, that's really hard.
Within maybe 3 or 4 weeks, that was very disappointing. Within 3 or 4 weeks, she discovered that my stepfather had been molesting my younger brother. He was about 6-7 years younger than I am, so he's been doing it for a year, and so at that point she went to the police and the district attorney, but she really just wanted to get a sense of what her power was. She, and this is my question, she allowed him to stay in the house, in the family, and he got therapy. It was actually psychiatric therapy at the time.
So Mick, and you know, for full disclosure here, this is my husband, and so I know this story. I think this is a really good place to ask our guest something about, you know, back then, this is a long time ago, you know, the idea that the person would stay in the house and keep you and your brothers frightened. I would imagine. I just want to ask our guests about that.
Yeah, I think it would be different now. I mean, I'm fairly sure it would be different now. We have gotten a lot better at understanding this from that perspective, and we've gotten a lot better at prosecuting these kinds of crimes and to, you know, listening to and believing kids. You know, it's interesting. I think it's very brave for a kid to speak up and to talk, to even tell their mom or to tell whoever. I mean, you know, the very, very, very worst things we can think of, we call those things unspeakable, you know, and kids are really, really brave when they can actually speak of them and talk to us about them. And I think we have gotten better at listening to them, believing them, and intervening, you know.
I do believe that we've gotten better. I think, however, that probably the reality is that a very small minority of cases actually ever get prosecuted. And I think mm-hmm. that Mick's story really reveals the sort of progressiveness of this type of abuse. I think the children that are lacking a significant father figure that's really involved, or parents that really sort of have that time and attention to play with the children, to talk to them, to teach them how to express themselves, these children are much more vulnerable. And Mick's story, I think, highlights really just the nature of that danger, is that you start with something that is very innocuous, very innocent. And for a child that really is missing that male bonding figure, to have a tap on the shoulder, to be tickled, you know, that's wonderful. That shows a little bit of affection. It shows that hunger for connection. And let's not forget that, you know, that need for us to bond and to belong, to be loved, is a very basic need, mm-hmm. More important than food many times. The problem is that very slowly that there are abuses of that confidence, and it gets to the point where it does become sexual. The issue is that oftentimes children are not able to tell how that line was ever crossed. And you get to the point where, as a child, you feel like you've participated in allowing this to happen, and so the guilt sets in, and then there come the bribes, and there come the threats, and before you know it, there is this whole concept of guilt and this whole concept of shame becomes such a part of your personality. So yeah. In many instances, we also have parents that have come either from abuse themselves, or have been involved in violence, or have been shrouded in secrecy, and so unfortunately, many cases never come to light, and right. and people mm-hmm. suffer, and people suffer, and though thank God that we do have media attention now, but the reality is that there are still many children out there and many adults suffering in silence.
And that's why even Mick, as this adult that you are, this person in their 60s, it's very courageous of you to even
Absolutely.
Speak this
Yes.
morning and to say something. It helps other people. Before we move on, Mick, is there something else about what Jorge just said that, or anything you want to ask?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. One, it's true things have gotten better, and I think that from what I know of, like the little stories about good touch, bad touch, that would have helped me if my mother had said, if anybody ever wants you to not tell me something, don't pay any attention to them. Tell me anyway.
Uh-huh.
Even if you agree not to tell me, go ahead, then come tell me.
Yeah, that
would have been
really
important at the time.
That's
but
one
my
of
question,
them.
My question is about having the situation I described. Has there ever been any successful rehabilitation of an offender who stayed within the family?
Yeah. Mm. Well, first of all, Debbie wants to say something about what you said before
that's actually one of the most important messages to parents in terms of prevention, or in terms of early intervention, if not prevention, but really finding out about these things as early as we can, is the, you know, talking about good touch and bad touch can be confusing, but the message to your child that you should never be asked to keep a secret from me, and if anyone asks you to keep a secret from me, then that's wrong, and you can tell me anyway, is the most important message you can give a kid, I think.
Yeah, and Mick, I want to say that we're going to go to a break now. So I just really so much appreciate you calling, and we'll address your question after the break. But thank you, and I hope other people will call about their experience dealing with child sexual abuse.
Thanks very much.
In a moment, we'll take your call. Today we're talking with Dr. Jorge Partida. He's a psychologist, author, and consultant to businesses in the media. And Debbie McCann, she's a forensic interviewer and multidisciplinary team leader at Community Violence Solutions. Join us on Facebook. And tell your friends to become part of our virtual community here on the radio, on Facebook. And if you need more resources or have something related to today's program that you need help with, you can email me at rona@childhoodmatters.org. I also want to mention to folks that I'll be doing a class at Parents Place on Wednesday, January 11th. It's called Was That Me Yelling? Perhaps you noticed that you lost it with your kids over the holidays a lot, and you want to start the new year off by yelling less. Come to join us, and you can check out this information at childhoodmatters.org. Dr. Jorge, when Mick was talking, yes. He asked a question that we didn't really address yet.
Yes, this is the question that Mick was asking is it possible for an offender to be rehabilitated and still stay in the family? And I think the answer is it's a great question. Unfortunately, I think it's a very difficult question to answer and very unlikely that a perpetrator can remain in the family and still have rehabilitated, to still be rehabilitated. It's not impossible, but the issue is really about family dynamics and power. How does a child get full disclosure and a full apology, and how does the dynamic of the parents change vis-a-vis the relationship that they have with that child? So the question is, you know, does the child always look at the perpetrator and see the abuse, or is there a healing that can simultaneously happen at the same time? And that's a very, very difficult thing. So most often, unfortunately, the most appropriate thing to occur is for the perpetrator to be removed from the home and no longer be a part of that re-traumatizing sort of impact. How often that actually happens, unfortunately, is less often than really should be happening, because most often families want to stay together. Parents have that bond, and then usually what happens is everybody participates in this culture of silence.
And often it's a financial reason.
Absolutely.
I can't send him away. What will happen? You know, I was reading a book by Aaron Marin. It's called Stolen Innocence: Triumphing Over Childhood Broken by Abuse, a memoir. And she was abused by a cousin, who she wouldn't tell anyone. She was too frightened to tell anyone. And then she would have to see him all the time at family events. And you could just feel from her diary how she was re-traumatized. 1-877-372-KIDS. We also have a message from one of our listeners, John from Salinas. He said that he had a little brother who was molested in the 70s by a close family friend. Their mom did nothing about it. John didn't find out about it until his brother was older and also came out of the closet. He later died of AIDS. Regarding the statute of limitations, John asks, is it different from state to state? Is there a federal law? He wishes something could have been done for his brother years later, especially since his mother had turned a blind eye at the time. And I just want to say, John, that, you know, I'm so sorry that, again, things happened that you weren't aware of, and there was no help, there was no treatment. So I want to ask you, Debbie, in terms of the law, I know that you're not an expert in the law, but is it different from state to state, and
yes,
is there a federal law?
I'm not a lawyer, but I have worked with lawyers in this area for a long time. And it is different from state to state. We're fortunate in California that things have changed a lot in the last couple of years. There are far stricter laws about these kinds of things and far longer sentences. Sentences have gotten really, really long. It's fairly common for cases that go to trial in California to have life sentences for child abuse, molest. But unfortunately, the question about statute of limitations and can something be done about something that happened a long time ago is very complicated, because it depends what the actual acts were, when it occurred, because it depends on what the statute of limitations was at the time that it occurred. And so it's not an easy question to answer without knowing a lot about when and what and everything. The other thing to know, though, that is that people's stories are still very important to them, obviously, but also, you know, when adults come forward about things that happened to them as children, that information can be used if that perpetrator has continued to victimize people and there is a current case, then that information can be useful to a current case, even if those crimes from the 70s can't be charged.
Mm-hmm.
That person voice can be heard and helpful in a current
prosecution. And when you said those stories are important, I realize on another level how important they are.
Yes.
To speak.
Yes.
And it's important if the abuse happened 20 years ago, that if you as a victim or a survivor of child abuse believe that person still has contact with children or has the likelihood of being around children, you have an obligation, not just to yourself to come out with your story, but you have an obligation to those children that could potentially be in danger. Age does not matter. We've seen grandparents, we've seen older adults abusing children. So I think it's important to keep in mind that there's, you know, it's never too late to say something.
Yes.
Thank you very much. 1-877-372-KIDS. Let's take another call now. We'll talk with Nancy in Richmond. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Rona. How are you?
Good. Thank you for calling. What would you like to add to this subject? It's a hard one, but one we've got to talk about.
Right. My father had a friend in our neighborhood, and I was probably between the ages of 10 and 12, and I loved horses at the time, like most young girls, and this person would take me to places where I could horseback ride, and he touched me, he had me touch him. He had a Barbie doll that he used to show me and put my hands on the doll and say, this is where I want to touch you. And it was very confusing because I loved being able to go to the places where he'd take me, but that was that quandary of, is this wrong? Is this right? And I remember at the time he died, oh gosh, when he was an older, like we used to call him Grandpa. And anyway, he died, and I remember the night my mom was telling me, and I just looked at her and I said, I'm so glad he's dead. I'm glad he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, why? And I told her.
Yes.
And she said she was glad that I told her.
Yes. And Nancy, how old were you?
I was probably between the ages of 8 and 10.
Yeah. First of all, I just want to say it just really touches my heart. And the fact that you're saying this is really important for people to hear, because so often it is someone trusted. And I think you also speak about how hard it is to know what to say, mm-hmm. whether to say, is this normal, is this not normal? It's so hard for children to understand this. Mm-hmm. And so often people will say, so why didn't the child say anything? And I'd like to ask my guests to respond to this, because children just don't. And, mm-hmm. and it is hard, especially when it's someone who's offering you positive things, when it's someone you love. And the experience you had of knowing that he died, I just want to acknowledge that too. It's a way in which that little girl in you was suddenly safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that nothing bad could happen anymore. That's how I interpret that. My guest, you want to say something?
I think that, you know, it's how is it that children don't speak up? I mean, I think it's important to recognize that, you know, we're talking about children understanding and learning from adult figures who they look up to as gods. I think that just, you know, from the cognitive development perspective, children really don't have the wherewithal to question authority. They really do look up and admire. I think the other question that, you know, Nancy and also Mick were talking about is that there's also that seduction that happens over time. Children want attention. They see the attention as positive. They get engaged in things that they enjoy, and with Nancy, horseback riding. And so, you know, you do get placed in a very precarious position where you're enjoying the contact, you're enjoying the attention, the affection, but then somewhere, somehow it starts to feel awkward. You don't have quite the words. I think even as an adult, you know, how would we understand inappropriate touching?
That's right. And sometimes it feels good.
Absolutely.
And that's the other piece that makes it all the more confusing.
Absolutely.
Right. I think confusing is a really apt way to describe it, because I don't think good touching and bad touching covers it. And it is almost always really confusing to kids. I mean, I have to ask kids often, you know, what made you decide not to tell, you know, without being judgmental about whether they did or did not tell, but just, you know, to find out what they were thinking at the time. And the number one answer You know, of course, every child is, every story is different, but the number one most common answer we get is, I thought I would get in trouble. Whether or not that's true, they think they're going to get in trouble for everything, right? If they think something wrong happened, they think it's their fault. They're very egocentric that way. And, you know, appropriately so. And the second most common answer is that they didn't want the perpetrator to get in trouble, and they knew that the perpetrator would get in trouble.
Yeah.
And so it is, it's very confusing. It's mixed up with affect, when affection that's, that feels appropriate and good and is appropriate and good then gets sort of mixed up with this other stuff. It's, that's what's really can be damaging long term.
And I wonder, Nancy, before we move on, if you can even remember what that sense was of why you shouldn't tell your mom.
He would say, "Oh, please don't sit. Tell. It'll make me sad. I'll cry.
Yeah.
I mean, he just and the hard thing was is he had grandchildren that I knew, and I would see the grandchildren and a granddaughter he had, and I just thought, why is he doing this to me?
Yes.
You know, Nancy, it's important. I mean, I would like to say to you as the adult, but I'd also like to say to the 10-year-old you that, you know, I hope that you really do understand that this was not your fault. I know it's confusing, and I, you know, nothing that you did was wrong.
Yeah.
About this.
It's an important message for us adults to hear who have dealt with this too. Thank you for saying
that. It's hard for
that.
Kids to know what to do, and they rarely know what to do, and we shouldn't expect them to know what to do.
And I think it's not just that it's not your fault, but it's also impersonal, unfortunately. More than likely, this person was also abusing other children, including perhaps his grandchildren. So, you know, that's the issue with sexual abusers. They're not as selective or as loyal to one child that's being abused. Usually it's perpetuated on other children that they have access to. So it's important to recognize that. I think it's also important to recognize that, you know, children don't know what shame is. I think that they're taught by adults. And when all of a sudden, you know, you're threatened or you're coerced or, in this case, you know, manipulated into not telling, it's a heavy burden because all of a sudden you recognize that something is horribly wrong and you just don't know how to put words to it. So you internalize that sense of something is very, very wrong here, but you don't really know how to deal with that.
And I just want to encourage all people listening, again, if you think about 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys are molested, sexually abused, we have a lot of listeners who have dealt with this and to know that it's never too late to get help. There are people who can go and do work with you as a, you know, a therapist or in a group to talk about it. And it may just be that you have a friend who you can talk to or a family member who also went through this. Stories are important. And I just want to honor you, Nancy, for calling in this morning. I don't know if you have children. I'd be happy to send you some passes or some books. Why don't you let our producer know? And again, thank you so much for speaking on the air. Have a good day, Nancy.
Thank you.
Take care now. Let's take a listen to some parents who were interviewed by Lorenzo, our producer, and see what they had to say about trying to prepare kids and help kids not be victims of child sexual abuse.
I'm associate producer Lorenzo Plazola, and I'm speaking to some parents at Studio Grow in Berkeley about preventing child sexual abuse. How do you teach your child the difference between inappropriate and appropriate touching?
I think it's important to tell your child early on that, you know, their private parts are just for them and no one is to touch them, meaning that they would have to understand to name what their private parts are and that it's not okay for anyone else to touch them.
At this age, they do masturbate, so she has space where she needs to go and do that, which is, you know, in the bathroom or in a private space, so that doesn't happen in front of others. And then as far as touching others, I don't really focus on it at this age at 2. She'll be in a bath with her friends, it's a boy, and she'll want to touch his penis or whatever. I don't even really pay too much attention to it at this age.
And when do you believe is an appropriate age to start talking to kids about this?
I think you do little by little as they get older, so maybe starting, my son is 2, so I've just started to tell him, you know, that no one is to touch his private parts, and then I think you kind of expand from there as they get older. You kind of feel out what's appropriate to give them a little more as they continue to grow and have different experiences and they're not with you every second of the day. So as they grow older, you'll need to increase the amount that you talk to them.
Later on, I plan to talk to her, maybe when she's preschool age. But I do teach her the parts of her body and spend a lot of time letting her know, having her learn about her body, because I think that's really useful for kids to learn their body and learn their parts of their body, because sometimes that ignorance leads to them being taken advantage of later in some ways. They need to know their own parts.
What do you think is the best way or the best method to inform kids but without scaring them?
I think it's just to teach kids just to be able to say no and set limits, and that it's okay to say no to someone else touching them.
I think it's okay to be direct and blunt. Make it a normal conversation so that they feel comfortable to come to you with whatever questions or concerns they have, so they don't feel like it's a taboo subject, but mommy and daddy talk openly about this, and if something were to happen or if they had a yucky feeling, they could come to me. So I want to make it like a normal part of conversation without making it over the top, dramatic, or scary.
What's the best way to respond to your kids' questions when they ask questions?
I think it's important to be clear and honest without maybe being too graphic, obviously, or I don't know. I think you just have to feel it out, what feels right and appropriate for your child. I think you're the only one that knows developmentally where they're at, what they can handle.
I think as openly as possible. I think that a good way to put it might be that some people don't know the difference between good and bad touching, and they weren't taught properly, and now I'm going to teach you, so that if someone doesn't know their own rules, then you know the rules.
For Childhood Matters, I'm Lorenzo Plazola.
Thank you, Lorenzo, and thank you to the parents at Studio Grow. Complicated. There are a lot of things here that I think we want to respond to, and I want to say, if you have a question, 1-877-372-KIDS. You could also email us at info@childhoodmatters.org, and you can use a different name if you're, feel embarrassed or have a reason that you want to keep your confidentiality. So, Debbie, these parents had a lot of good information. Anything that struck you that you want to tweak a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the first thing is that, people talked about telling your kids the truth, which I think is good advice. You want to tell your kids the truth, not the whole truth when they're two or three, but, just as much as developmentally appropriate that they can handle, and parents know their kids best in that way. I do want to talk just really quickly about the good and bad touch kind of conversation, because we really are moving away from that, framing it that way, as much as possible, because it really doesn't reflect the reality of kids' experiences. And so it can be confusing for them and even traumatizing for them, depending on, their experience, because kids don't always experience sexual abuse in the moment as a bad touch. It doesn't always hurt. It's not always scary. It could be someone who's not scary to them, who they have a lot of affection for. And sometimes it can even feel good, honestly, depending on how it's presented. It's often presented as a game, and so it can be confusing. And so So if that's happened to a child and then they get the good and bad touch conversation, you can see how it can be confusing, because, one of the risk factors is that kids can become sexually reactive, which means they act out inappropriately with other kids. And so are sexually reactive kids bad kids? Because are they doing bad touches? Or if a kid let a bad touch happen, does that make them bad? Or, if the touch was bad but they liked it, are they
right.
then bad?
And if grandpa's taking a shower with you and you're two and you're all bubbled up and you're having fun,
right.
That's not necessarily a bad touch.
Exactly. And it, there's a lot of appropriate caretaking touch that could be labeled as a bad touch, especially when, I heard someone say to, she says to her 2-year-old that no one should touch their private parts. Well, and, we do touch 2-year-olds' private parts all the time.
Right.
All kinds of people
That's
touch them all the
time. That's why it's so complicated. This book, a very touching book, talks a little bit about secret touching,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a good red flag.
Right.
That when it's something that, is secret, that, mm-hmm. that yucky feeling you get when you're confused about mm-hmm. someone telling you to keep a secret.
Right.
Anything stand out for you in this?
Well, I think that, people are, it sounds like, more and more parents are looking for the warning signs, and they're sensitive to how this happens with children. I think that's wonderful to be able to watch your own child. I think that, even at a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old, if you notice that your child is spending a lot of attention on his private parts, there's some of that touching is natural self-exploration, but there's also the sense of, obsession when it becomes sort of a focal point, then that's where I think we have to also begin to pay attention. We see children often touching themselves overly, and especially when they've been sexually abused, there are sensations that are awakened, and that becomes a manner of children showing you sometimes that there might be something to look at.
And a lot to sort out there, because it's self-soothing for some kids, mm-hmm. depending on their temperament. And so that's where sometimes you need to talk to someone. And I want to say Community Violence Solutions is a great place because yes. they have a 24-hour hotline. Yes. And the number there is, let me see, I think I have it in case yes. you don't know it by heart. It's 800-670-7273. 800-670-7273. If you feel like you need some advice. Thank you both very much. Mm-hmm.
Don't change that dial. You've been listening to Childhood Matters. Find out more at childhoodmatters.org.
Thank you. And we're going to take a message from one of our callers. And she asked, how do you know, she'd like to know about when the abuse happens within a family, as in a child on child abuse. How can they heal from that? How does a family rebuild after something like this? The children she's thinking of were about 2 years apart in this case. Mm-hmm. And I think, it's important that it be spoken about, and then I think the family gets help from a therapist mm-hmm. To sort of help navigate all that's going on. Anything you want to say about
that? Yeah, I mean, I think that when a kid may be sexually reactive and maybe having some inappropriate sexual behavior with other children, they are not necessarily bad kids, and they are, they also need help. And we don't like to see children as offenders. Some people like to kind of frame them as offenders if they've done something to another child. But, if they're young, they're not, it's not really appropriate to see them as an offender. And those kids are going to stay in the same family. And I think what you need to have some real clear rules about safety for both of those children. It's important to, have a lot of supervision and rules for both child's sake, because you want to keep the sexually reactive child safe from that kind of behavior as well, and help them deal with it. So I think that we do see that kind of thing working out when parents are really committed to the safety of both children and making and keeping to some real clear family rules about privacy and about appropriate behavior.
Right, and there's so much to talk about in regard to this too, because kids will play doctor and they'll explore, their private parts, and that's not necessarily something, quote, bad.
Right.
But there becomes a time when the power shifts and also it's hard to know how to supervise children.
Right.
The key thing there is not, if you walk in on kids who are playing at home, don't freak out.
Right.
That's the number one thing, is to not shame them.
Right. I want to say a couple quick things about that, because if you've got, there is no real complete right answer, because every case is different. But in general, if you have two kids who are having some sexual exploration or play, they're similar age, they're familiar playmates, and they can be redirected by adults, gently, not freaking out adults, but, then they can stop when asked to stop, then that's all seems very, very normal. I mean, if you have a big age difference, if you have any coercion going on, if you have, any of those other factors, and particularly if you have oral genital contact between young children, that is not something they think of generally themselves, and that is something that is a big, big, big red flag.
That's right, to know whether something's happened to one of these children.
Or they've been exposed to something that's beyond their, it's not appropriate, it's beyond their maturity.
Well, this leads right into another piece we're going to listen to. It's from the author of I Said No. It's a kid-to-kid guide to keeping private parts private by Zach and Kimberly King. Zach is the child and the mother is Kimberly King. Let's take a listen.
Lorenzo Plazola Jr. here for Childhood Matters. Now I'm speaking with Kimberly King, the author of I Said No, about her son's experience and what parents can do to keep their kids safe. What inspired you to write this book?
We wrote the book after a traumatic night my son went through at a sleepover. He shared with me that his friend was trying to do all these inappropriate things to him all night long, and he ended up reporting what was going on to the mom, and she wasn't listening or believing him. So he ended up going to the bathroom and saying he was sick and locked himself in the bathroom and slept on the floor. So he avoided the situation all on his own, but the whole night really traumatized him, and he felt real guilty about what went on. So we sort of wrote the book out of kind of a need to talk about it.
How early do you think, in your opinion, parents should start informing their kids about this subject?
when you're potty training and trying to teach your child how to take care of themselves, I mean, that's a really good time to start talking about who is okay to help clean them and take care of them and who's not. That's when we started talking. And then when they get older at school age, then it's really important to talk about the whole topic of modesty. That comes out a lot because different kids have varying levels of modesty. And when you're 5, 6, 7, 8 in elementary school, things do happen and you just have to really be open and honest with your children about the scenarios that they might encounter.
What do you think are some of the red flags that children should look out for?
We talk a lot in the book about identifying your feelings, and those feelings will eventually give you a red flag. So if your child finds themselves feeling worried, uncomfortable, or like they have this little inner voice in their head that is telling them something is just not right, then they need to start to learn to identify their feelings so that they can act on them and possibly prevent a situation from occurring. And usually if something doesn't feel right, it's not right.
How did you help your child trust other people after that incident?
We didn't have any sleepovers, and I kind of limited who they were with and time that they spent with other people because of it, and until he felt secure enough to ever do another sleepover. So I wasn't really willing for him to do another sleepover until he felt totally secure and fine with it. So at age 10, he did a sleepover, and it was a neighbor, and he had my cell phone, and he had a plan if he needed to go, and we talked to the parents beforehand and said, you know what, if anything goes wrong, it's perfectly fine if he wants to come back at 2 in the morning, even if he's just worried about sleeping over a friend's house, that's fine.
And finally, overall, what advice do you give the parents to keep their children safe?
It's not enough just to say to the child, here's what you do to keep your private parts safe. That's one thing, but you actually have to talk about like what's normal human sexual curiosity and what's normal and what's not normal, and kind of really clarify specific situations for your kids so that they know what to do and give them the tools to like develop kind of like an escape or a plan to get out of a situation.
Besides your book, I Said No, what other resources do you suggest for parents?
I think one of the best resources out there right now, there's an organization called Darkness to Light. So it's their website is www.darkness2light.org. And on there is a training seminar for parents and teachers and anybody who takes care of children. It's called Stewards of Children. And it is this wonderful training program that takes about 2 hours to do online, and you can get so much information off of that. And one of the biggest things I think parents need to do is it's really important to check out places like daycare centers and make sure they're certified and registered with the state, and you know, really get to know your children's friends and your children's friends' parents, and any activity that involves sports or church or any reason where your child might be alone with anybody else, you really need to make sure that those organizations have policies and procedures for keeping kids safe.
For Childhood Matters, I'm Lorenzo Plazola.
Well, thank you, Lorenzo, and thank you to Kimberly King. And Debbie, a lot of information there. Anything mm-hmm. stand out for you that you want to comment on as we kind of wind down here?
Well, just how fortunate, you know, kids who have supportive caregivers and parents are, and parents who will listen to them and respond. And just to remember, you know, that kids, even kids who have been molested, kids who have been abused, are healthy, whole kids, and they're not doomed to a life of, you know, being victims or being perpetrators forever. And, you know, those with supportive caregivers and reasonable intervention really, really do well and, you know, can heal, and healing can happen.
So I think that's really important. And I think what she was saying about sleepovers, I want to say, is that the important thing is to do your due diligence. Mm. You know, that sleepovers can be fabulous mm-hmm. things for kids, but you really do want to know the family. You mm-hmm. want to talk to them about, if my child seems upset, call me. I don't care what time of night it is. Mm-hmm. You don't want to, and I, you know, we all make mistakes, and I certainly have made them as a parent, but you don't want to just send your child to someone's house because it's a schoolmate and you've never mm-hmm. met the family.
Right.
And, you know, there could be issues around guns. There could right. be issues about safety in other mm-hmm. ways. So I think what the message here is, take the time.
Right.
To do some due diligence. Dr. Jorge, anything stand out from you from what Kimberly King said?
Well, I think that the concept of being able to listen to your child and being able to help your child have a plan of action if they ever find themselves alone in a situation like this is vitally important. Children need to feel that their word matters. I think that, you know, also just to talk about how children can heal, it's important to get to the point where we disclose in order for that healing to take place. And I think children's words and this time of disclosure are critical. So listening to your child is very important.
Well, Dr. Jorge Padilla, I want you to tell people how they can get a copy of your books. I want to mention that you've written two books, The Promise of the Fifth Son, Ancestral Journey of Self-Discovery, and also A Week of Awakening, A Practical Guide to Personal Transformation. How do people get that?
Thank you, Rana. You can get both books on Amazon.com. They're available in, actually, the first one is available in Spanish. The second one should be available in Spanish this month. And then you can also just look at my website, www.drjorge.net.
And it's important it's the .net because I found a different Dr. Jorge when I went, so it's drjorge.net. I hope you'll come back again.
Always a pleasure.
Debbie McCann, how can people find out about Community Violence Solutions?
Well, they can call Community Violence Solutions. They can call the hotline anytime, as you gave the number, is 800-670-7273.
Say it again.
800-670-7273. Community Violence Solutions is the Rape Crisis Center for Contra Costa and Marin Counties, and we have a lot of other, other services and programs as well. So people should call whenever they need to.
Well, I'm so glad there are people like you talking to children when they're at their most vulnerable spot. My final word is, if you're a parent who is a victim of sexual abuse when you were young, don't hesitate to get support as you struggle to raise your children and provide them with a safe and loving home. It takes courage to face your feelings as you break the cycle of abuse. And if you know a child that's been abused, remember that with honesty, compassion, and effort, people can heal and go on to have productive lives. Thank you to our guests, to our listeners, our team, Felsha Zuschlag, producer, and Lorenzo Plazola, producer at the controls. My gratitude to my children, Pei, Mara, Matt, and Karina, and my husband, Mick. This is Rona saying goodbye until next week. Spend time with your child, and don't forget to take good care of yourself. Childhood matters, and so do you.
You've been listening to Childhood Matters.
Produced by Collins Media Services and presented by the nonprofit Interactive Parenting Media. Join us again for Childhood Matters. Find out more at childhoodmatters.org.